listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I believe that the entire FISA application, including the affidavit attached, taking out methods and sources, should be released to the American people so we have a full context of what was the basis for the application from an evidence standpoint.
That was Representative Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas, who chairs the House Committee on Homeland Security, speaking Monday at a panel presentation at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security in Washington, D.C.
I believe Americans, whether Democrat or Republican, need have a right to see that.
McCaul provided more detail in his response to Frank Salufo, who's the director of the center at GW.
It's dominating the news, so I think we've got to zero in on your colleague on the House Permanent Select Committee of Intelligence recently released a memo, and I'd be curious what some of your thoughts are since it's gripping much of D.C. right now.
Well, first, in terms of background, I was a federal prosecutor. I worked on FISA applications with the FBI. It's probably the most serious power within the federal government to have national security wiretaps, FISA, to monitor American citizens in the United States or Americans deemed to be an agent of a foreign power. So I look at it from that context that these applications need to be based on evidence. My concern after reading the document, and granted it was coming from the Republican side, was that one of the principal pieces of evidence was a dossier memo that then FBI Director Comey came out later to say was salacious and unverifiable. In addition to that document was a Yahoo article, a press report, which in my judgment, I have deep respect for the press, but it's not evidence. I mean, this has to be based on evidence. before you put a wiretap on someone in the United States to demonstrate probable cause they are an agent of a foreign power. So given what the FBI director said about the dossier, I find that difficult to believe that that is sufficient evidence to uphold the application. In my experience, there would be a duty to notify the FISA court when it was deemed by the FBI director that it was salacious and unverifiable. To my knowledge, I'm not sure that happened. I think it should have happened. I think the court may have viewed this application in a different light. But having said, there are two things I think that need to happen going forward. And granted, I think from the American Observer, you're seeing a Republican memo and you're going to see a Democrat memo come out. I think to really get to the bottom of this for the American people, two things need to happen. I believe that the entire FISA application, including the affidavit attached, taking out methods and sources, should be released to the American people so we have a full context of what was the basis for the application from an evidence standpoint. I believe Americans, whether Democrat or Republican, need have a right to see that. Secondly, and lastly, and I know we want to move on, is that I do believe the Inspector General is looking into a couple of these FBI agents' political motivation with respect to some of these politically charged investigation. When I was at the Justice Department in public integrity section, we prided ourselves on not being partisan. Nobody knew what your political affiliation was, and that was for a reason, because we were not supposed to bring our politics into that office because it undermines the integrity of the institution and the credibility. And that should not have happened in this case. The IG is looking at this particular investigation, but I would respectfully request and recommend that the IG also expand his investigation into this FISA warrant application to determine whether it was valid or not. And if it's not, then it should not go forward.
Zalufo spoke with three other of McCall's Republican colleagues on the House Committee on Homeland Security, Representatives John Katko from New York, Will Hurd from Texas, and Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin. This was Representative John Katko from New York, who, before being elected to the House of Representatives in 2015, served as an assistant U.S. attorney and chief of the Organized Crime Division at the U.S. Attorney's Syracuse office, where he prosecuted cases under the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO.
I was a federal organized crime prosecutor for 20 years, and in that capacity, I did well over 100 wiretap applications. When you do wiretap applications, it's incumbent upon you not only to show the probable cause you have to be able to tap a phone or tap a computer or what have you, but you also, it's also incumbent upon you to make sure that the information you have is fully and fairly and accurately portrayed. If you just put all the good information in a wiretap affidavit, but you don't discuss the things in there that may tend to be derogatory information about the sources you're using, then you're not providing an accurate picture to the judge. If you don't provide an accurate picture to the judge, then you're not following the standards of the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So in this case, the fact that certain things weren't disclosed in a FISA or a wiretap affidavit to the judge is troubling to me, because it doesn't present the judge with a full picture of what this person's about. You have an informant, basically, a source. And you don't tell them that, you tell them the things that are helpful to your case, but you don't tell them, well, he's being paid by the party who he's trying to go after and he has a personal vendetta against. That would be a very germane thing for a wiretap affidavit. That that's not in there, a judge may want to take that evidence, he could suppress it. If you suppress that evidence, all the fruit from that evidence is going to be suppressed as well. So that's a problem. That was a big glaring thing I saw when I read the memo the first time. But what we're saying about the Federal Bureau of Investigation and Department of Justice, I worked at DOJ for 20 years as a prosecutor. I traveled all over the world with them. And I routinely had task forces everywhere I went. Political corruption cases, organized crime cases, police corruption cases, you name it. And the FBI was always by my side, along with DEA and many others. And I can tell you, they're highly professional. And so when you have things like this, from an oversight capacity. It's incumbent upon us to get it out in the open, discuss it, and fix it, and use it as an example so it doesn't happen again.
After the release on Friday of the memo, Answer Coalition Chair Brian Becker and whistleblower John Kiriakou, who host Loud and Clear on Radio Sputnik, spoke with Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer from Pittsburgh, and attorney Kevin Zeese from Baltimore, who's the co-coordinator of PopularResistance.org. This was co-host Brian Becker.
Let's start with some words from the former FBI director, James Comey.
Yeah, James Comey, who is now, at least among Democrats, somehow acknowledged as some sort of a senior statesman.
I thought he was the reason Hillary Clinton lost. Wait a second.
Right. That was only for a little while.
Oh, okay.
Now he and John Brennan and Mike Hayden are really the people that we ought to be aspiring to.
Our champions.
So James Comey just tweeted this, quote, "That's it? Question mark. Dishonest and misleading memo wrecked the House Intel Committee, destroyed trust with the intelligence community, damaged relationship with FISA court, and inexcusably exposed classified investigation of an American citizen. For what? DOJ and FBI must keep doing their jobs," unquote.
Okay. Kevin Zeese, you want to react to your former FBI director, your leader, James Comey?
I have to ask also, for what is right? You're investigating Carter Page after he's left the Trump campaign for his ties to Russia, which have been long known since back to the, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. So big deal. What's the issue? And I don't understand the Democrats' response about this, all fear of these exposing methods of surveillance and secrecy. We're talking about the Steele memo. That's not a big secret.
That's the method. There's one method. There's one source. That's called Christopher Steele.
In a Yahoo News article.
Also really secretly authored, even though Michael Isikoff is the author, it's really Christopher Steele.
Right, but so big deal. That's not a big secret method that the Democrats are fighting about. But on the other hand, now you have this whole Russiagate thing. Okay, should it continue? Should it have even started? I mean, the lack of proof on Russiagate, I think, is the first place to raise questions. But now we're getting into this obstruction of justice stuff, and Trump is implying he's going to fire Rod Rosenstein, which means that he's going to essentially file Mueller. Now we're getting into a whole different fight. It's not about Russiagate anymore. Now it's about Trump just abusing his power as president to stop an investigation.
Well, that's what Watergate was, except... Perhaps there were underlying crimes. None have been proved in the case of the Russiagate. I want to go back and again help the audience, because I think people are just lost in this, and people have sort of switched sides. The Democrats are now the liberals are the champions of the FBI, and asserting that Russia's carrying out this, you know, terrible takeover of America. But I want to go back to where this all started. Christopher Steele was hired by Fusion GPS and he was hired back in April 2016. Originally, it was the Republican rivals of Donald Trump who set this process into motion. And here's a sort of a commentary about what was going on. In April 2016, Mark Elias, a partner in the large Seattle-based firm Perkins Coie and head of its political law practice, hired Fusion GPS to do opposition research on Trump. Elias was the attorney of record for the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton presidential campaign. Now, that's April 2016. I want people to remember this in terms of George Papadopoulos and when the FBI gets in on the act in July 2016. But this is April 2016. As part of their investigation, Fusion GPS hired Orbis Business Intelligence, a private British intelligence firm, to look into connections between Trump and Russia. Now, Christopher Steele said that they only told him one thing. Now, this is the DNC. This is research, opposition research. They had one question for him to research, and here it is. They gave me no specific marching orders, quote, beyond this basic question: why did Mr. Trump repeatedly seek to do deals in a notoriously corrupt police state that most serious investors shun? That was it. That's how this started. That's how this started. And when you think about it, business people are doing business in Russia from all over the world.
Constantly.
And whether you call it names and you use caricatured language, the notorious police state, corrupt, something that serious investors shun. I don't know who they are. Is that ExxonMobil? I thought ExxonMobil, they're serious investors. They were doing business there. But what about Saudi Arabia? What about all the other countries in the world where serious investors are also doing business? But from the beginning, this story was incentivized based on an effort by Donald Trump's political opponents. And thus, one cannot, if you look at the genesis of the campaign, say something other than this is a political campaign. It was a political campaign in search of facts. And when facts weren't available, they came up with unvetted data. And John Kiriakou, you've talked about this a lot. The Steele dossier, these 16, 17 memoranda, none of that material is vetted.
No, none of it. Literally none of it is vetted. And in any normal situation, none of that information would have even made its way to the principals. What happens is the information goes to...
So you're talking about if for FBI or CIA.
Correct.
Or
correct. It would go to a team of analysts, and the analysts would vet the information. And if it can't be vetted, it's dropped. It's ignored because it likely can't be trusted. But that's not what happened here. What happened here was that every rumor, every innuendo was taken as fact. And that's what was put forward.
Yeah. So Dan Kovalik, I mean, Christopher Steele is incentivized because he's a hired hand. He's not trying to come up with an FBI report about a target. He's just coming up with information that will make his client happy, and his client will be happy if he comes up with dirt against Donald Trump. And by the way, when you really think about this, Christopher Steele was working in Russia, a foreign agent, yeah. Christopher Steele, working in Russia, collecting data against a political rival running for president of the United States, Donald Trump. Wouldn't that be kind of meddling? I mean, using Russia to meddle in American elections?
Well, of course. Of course. And of course, there's a lot of interesting things to say here. I mean, first of all, you know, when we talk about corrupt police states, the United States comes to mind. It seems like the pot calling the kettle black here. But putting that aside, you know, the specter of Nixon, you know, was raised here. And I think you're going to hear a lot of comparisons to Nixon, again, possibly in terms of Trump's decision to ultimately get the Mueller investigation ended. But what really looks Nixonian to me here is, frankly, using the FBI, as they were here, to go after a political opponent. That's Nixonian. So it's the Obama administration and its FBI that is acting in ways that are inappropriate.
That's right.
And again, they do remind me of Nixon. And I think that cannot be forgotten. And I think Democrats, whether they like Obama or not, have to be critical of that.
And again, and Kevin and John, too, if you want to jump in, I mean, we're talking about what the FISA the representations of the FISA court originally in October 2016, and then every 90 days it's renewed. But, you know, it was at that same time in October 2016 that the FBI actually reached an agreement with Steele to pay him to continue his work.
That's right.
I mean, he's hired by Republican rivals of Trump. Then Trump wins the nomination, so they stop paying him. Or it looks like he's going to. The Fusion GPS and the Democratic National Committee, or the law firm working for them, representing him, they pick him up. And then in October of 2016, right before the election, James Comey, then director of FBI, asks says that he'll start to pay Christopher Steele, too, to be a part of the FBI, well, on the payroll. Is that normal, John?
No, that is not normal. The FBI normally does not pay for information. The CIA certainly does, but that's the nature of intelligence. The FBI is a law enforcement organization, and they don't pay for information because that is generally seen as sort of gumming up the works. This was unusual. This was not something that was in the normal course of FBI business. And Brian, I mentioned to you offline before we started this segment, I know Christopher Steele. I worked with Christopher Steele, and I don't recognize this Christopher Steele. This is not the guy that I knew 20 years ago.
Meaning what exactly?
He's such a far more respected and qualified law enforcement officer than this is making him look to be. It's as though he was either in over his head or he had such a deep hatred of Donald Trump that he allowed that to get the better of him.
Yeah, well, that's a plausible motivation. I mean, you can look at Donald Trump and find a lot wrong with Donald Trump. Sure. Certainly, we have been foremost critics of Donald Trump.
Yes.
So that would be a plausible explanation for someone's motivation, in addition to the fact that he was getting paid lots of money to
six figures.
Now here we have Kevin, James Comey's led FBI was willing to pay Steele, but then they decided not to. And Steele, according to I'm going back to the Nunes memo here. Steele was suspended and then terminated as an FBI source for what the FBI defines as the most serious of violations, an unauthorized disclosure to the media of his relationship with the FBI in an October 30th, 2016 Mother Jones article by David Korn. Well, anyway, go ahead. Talk about that.
Wow. Boy, this whole Russiagate thing has so many different spins to it. And the desire of the intelligence community, the Pentagon, the FBI, to make sure they can control Donald Trump, I think really is a large part of what was going on with this whole Russiagate stuff. Beyond the Democrats trying not to admit they screwed up the election and had a terrible candidate, there's also this desire to make sure that this loose cannon president who is talking about America first and working with Russia, you know, that they have to control him. And so I'm not surprised they wanted to continue to work with Steele until he, you know, got in trouble for talking to the media. But because Steele could have been helpful in controlling Donald Trump if he became president. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot of this whole Mueller investigation is about. And they've not found very much on Russiagate. You know, a little bit of RT reporting on the presidential race. Wow, that's really unusual for a media outlet to report on a presidential race. Some Facebook and tweet advertising, half of which was after the election was already over. I mean, there's not much there so far. And so they're really pushing this. And Trump is now going to start pushing back.
And also, as they keep doing it, I was just looking at the polls today. Trump and the Republicans' polls are going up because I think actually the American people, one, don't care about this. I mean, maybe a small part of the population does, but most people are like, do I have a job? Do I have decent wages? Can I get my kids to a doctor? I mean, basic things like that. Anyway, I want to go back and read again from the memo, and then Dan Kovalik and Kevin, throw it back to you. Before and after Steele was terminated by the FBI, as a source, he maintained contact with the Department of Justice via then Associate Deputy Attorney General Bruce Orr, a senior DOJ official who worked closely with Deputy Attorneys General Yates and later Rosenstein. Shortly after the election, the FBI began interviewing Orr, that's Deputy Attorney General Orr, documenting his communications with Steele. For example, in September 2016, Steele admitted to Orr his feelings against then-candidate Trump when Steele said, quote, he was desperate that Donald Trump not get elected and was passionate about him not being president, close quote. There is clear evidence of Steele's bias was recorded by Orr at the time and subsequently in official FBI files, but not reflected in any of Page's FISA applications. In other words, they were maybe citing Steele's research, but not saying Steele was politically opposed to Trump. But here's the next point, and I want people to really listen to it. During the same time period, Orr, that's Deputy Attorney General Orr's wife, was employed by Fusion GPS to assist in the cultivation of opposition research on Trump. Orr later provided the FBI with all of his wife's opposition research paid for by the DNC and Clinton campaign via Fusion GPS. The Orr's relationship with Steele and Fusion GPS was inexplicably concealed from the court. Now, again, we don't know if this is true. This is the Nunes memo. Maybe there's some disingenuous way this is being worded.
But it sounds pretty damning the way it's written.
All of it sounds plausible.
Sure.
Let's put it that way.
Sure.
All of it sounds plausible. And I can remember back at the time of the Democratic National Convention, remember when WikiLeaks released all those embarrassing emails about how the Democratic National Committee was twisting and turning the primary process so that Hillary Clinton would definitely defeat Bernie Sanders. And all these documents came out showing that the DNC was breaking its own rules. And what was the response of the Democratic Party officials? Don't read those documents. Don't read those emails because they came from the Russians. Put your hands over your ears. Put your hands over your eyes. Don't read them. And of course, people did read them. It doesn't work to tell people don't read the stuff. And then Deborah Wasserman Schultz had to resign. Donna Brazile, who became interim chairperson, who was also telling people don't read the emails. Then she had to step down because some of the emails showed that she was giving debate questions from CNN, where she was a commentator, in advance to Hillary Clinton. I mean, the idea that that there's political bias in Washington for one candidate over another, like, that's completely plausible. And and the response, don't listen to these emails, don't read them because they come from the wrong source. I just think a large part of the American population is not going to buy that. Go ahead, Dan Kovalik.
Yeah, well, I agree. I agree that it's my sense that people are getting pretty weary of the whole Russiagate investigation to begin with. I think this is just going to add to people's desire to have this thing over with. But the other thing that just comes to mind, again, when I think about this memo and think about what's happened, where, again, I do think the FBI is being used somehow, and the FISA courts are being used for political gain, in this case, by the DNC, and before that, apparently by others in the Republican Party who didn't want Trump to win. It just makes me very uneasy that this is happening. Again, we know that this has happened before, but one has to question, frankly, how democratic our system is when this is happening. And again, the irony of ironies is that, you know, the whole Russiagate narrative revolves around the claim that Russia somehow stole our democracy. I don't see a lot of democracy here to be stolen, to be honest.
That's so true.
Well, as I said earlier, it seems to me that this is whatever you call it, a representative democracy. We have an FBI-led state. I mean, the FBI is the dominant political power. The only thing that's happened here is there's a little glimmer where you get to see what the FBI does routinely. And as we talked about earlier, going to the FISA court, getting warrants against people, no corroboration really of the evidence, and then beginning mass or individualized surveillance against people that can ruin people's lives. People may not even know about it. I mean, that's the real thing. And again, going back, FISA was passed, again, the FISA powers and the FBI and NSA and CIA's ability to use the FISA court. All the Congress people voted for that, again, giving them more and more power. And what do you expect? We know that this goes on day in and day out, that the FBI is, in fact, a criminal enterprise. I mean, it functions like a criminal enterprise. Kevin Zeese, go ahead.
So true. And, the fact that the Deputy Attorney General's wife, Bruce Orr's wife, worked for Fusion GPS and was developing this opposition research, and that was kept from the court, that is pretty damning. That is pretty damning. But, of course, what's really important, I think, in this section you read going forward is the point they make that after Steele was terminated, Rod Rosenstein stayed in touch with close contact with him. Once again, Rosenstein's a target for Trump. This is about obstruction of justice, and it's going to be about getting rid of Rosenstein and getting rid of Mueller. That's what this memo is really designed to accomplish. The issues that we're concerned with about FBI abuse, about the FISA court abuse, about intelligence gathering on individuals, that is bipartisan support. That's not going to be part of the narrative discussed in between the Republicans and Democrats. What will be discussed is what happens to Rod Rosenstein, what happens to the Russiagate investigation. And this you can, as you go through this memo, you see his name coming up over and over because that's going to be used by Trump to get rid of Rosenstein.
I have to agree. I can't imagine that Rod Rosenstein survives another week in this administration. I think probably what he should be worried about is whether the Republicans are going to now demand that the Justice Department look at him for obstructing justice.
And then you're going to have the Democrats and a lot of the liberals rallying behind Rod Rosenstein, like they rallied behind James Comey, as if guardians of freedom and the guardians of democracy. And that would mean the so-called resistance to Trump under these circumstances would not just be irrelevant. It would be actually reactionary. I mean, it would be more reactionary than the reactionaries, because one, it's designed to enhance confrontation with Russia. But maybe even more importantly, it would be to allow the FBI to aggregate to itself even greater power. If the liberals in America are the ones who are saying the FBI, in fact, under these circumstances, is the champion or the guardian of, quote, our democracy, that's a blank check for the FBI to step it up against people all over the country. Dan Kovalik.
Yeah, well, I agree. I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, the so-called resistance in many ways has become reactionary for the reasons you say, not only because, again, they seem to now have this unquestioning faith in the FBI and the CIA, but also are pushing, it seems to me, or at least some elements of it, are pushing for more military confrontations around the world, particularly with Russia. And, you know, this has just gone insane. The Russiagate, the whole Russiagate scandal has just been, to me, so devastating for this country, and it could turn out for the rest of the world. And again, it's a shame that people who otherwise have good politics are the ones that are seem to be pushing this.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Shaming has long been the preferred tool of American foreign policy, but the new Kremlin list released by the White House gives it a more institutionalized form. Formally speaking, those included in the list have done nothing malicious. They're just guilty by association. But at a time when being from Russia is already an accepted cause for suspicion and perhaps even discrimination, does the publication of this list really change much? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Eric Ferrari, a Washington-based defense attorney specializing in sanctions. Mr. Ferrari, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and happy to be here.
I think it's fair to say that when the so-called Kremlin list was published, the wealthy Russians breathed a collective sigh of relief. They certainly expected something both more biting and more precise. I wonder, though, if you believe this relief may be a little bit premature. Do you think the worst is yet to come?
Yes, I do. And I think that is reflected in Secretary Mnuchin's comments to Congress earlier this week that this list could be a preview for future sanctions designations.
Now, many observers have pointed out that in compiling this report, the Trump administration has essentially copy-pasted both the Kremlin's phone book and the Forbes magazine's list of wealthiest Russians. What do you make of this wholesale method of compilation?
Well, so it's not uncommon for the Treasury to use unclassified and open source material to prepare such a report or a list. And the point about the Forbes list and the copy-paste from that list is interesting, because if you notice and you're paying attention, some of the same spelling mistakes that were contained in the Forbes list have also been carried over into the Treasury report.
Well, you say it's not uncommon to rely on public source materials, but at the same time, I think this report essentially makes no distinction between people who are friendly to the Kremlin and people who have been, it could be argued, persecuted by the Kremlin. So is there any substance to it? Because from the Russian point of view, it's just publishing a list about who is who in Russian politics and in Russian business.
Yeah, well, if you take a look at the report, it sets out what the designation criteria is. And to your point, you're correct in that some of the criteria is related to senior political officials in Russia, and some is just based on net worth. And therefore, you could have that latter group of people not have any ties to the Russian government whatsoever and still find themselves in the report.
Mm-hmm. But then one should ask, what's the point of compiling this report in the first place? And I don't know if you would agree with me, but I think there is a certain degree of, I think, trolling and even ridicule in that, at least targeting not so much Russia, but the Congress. Do you think the way this report has been compiled, is it in keeping, is it in compliance with the Congress requirements?
I think they did their best to comply. I think they actually added more information than I even expected them to add. To your point, though, the design of this report was to be a name and shame list. And the effect, the practical effect of it is that people, business partners, people in joint ventures, banks that are engaged in transactions with these parties would move away from them or enhance due diligence in regards to their commercial activities and give a higher level of scrutiny to those activities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and this is what many U.S. officials have suggested, that this list was designed to be some sort of a psychological tool. And if you take into account the amount of fretting among the Russian business elite on the eve of the of its release, I think that objective was definitely met. But given you know, the pre-existing conditions, the already existing environment with regards of to the Russian companies doing business in the United States, do you really think it changes much? Because from my understanding, the environment had already been pretty toxic even before the release of this report.
No, I think that's a good point. The environment was already rather toxic. What I've heard is that certain banks are now including the people identified in the report on their politically exposed persons list and subjecting them to enhanced due diligence. And there's potentially going to be some of those parties offboarded from their financial institutions. So I do think it's going to have some practical effect. But to your point, there was already a toxic environment, and many of those parties were already either sanctioned or subject to such enhanced due diligence.
Now, Mr. Ferrari, just a technical question. I know that you are helping your clients to navigate various sanctions regimes, and formally speaking, these are not sanctions. This is some sort of a quasi official document, a little bit like a Wikipedia page verified by Treasury Secretary. What's the right way of thinking about this report in legal terms? Does it actually compel the American financial institutions to do anything about the people who are listed?
No, it doesn't. And Treasury stated right in the report, this is not a sanctions list, which is why it was so surprising when later on in the week, Treasury and Secretary Mnuchin mentioned that this report could be a preview of potential future sanctions targets. After heavily caveating the report and saying it's not a sanctions list and there are no legal restrictions. So nobody has any legal obligation to do anything with respect to this report. But I think you'll find that when you work in sanctions long enough, you see that the private sector does respond sometimes severely, even when they don't have to, when you get into this area of law.
Well, I guess it's better to be safe than sorry. There are two main strategies, as far as I can understand, that the wealthy Russians can employ in this situation. One is to rely on the lobbies in Washington and try to secure their capitals and investments. And another would be to liquidate their American holdings altogether. Which one do you think is more prudent at this point of time?
I think the latter strategy. I think divesting from the U.S. and moving your assets abroad, particularly when they're stating that some of these people may be designated at some point in the future under a sanctions program, is probably the right way to go. I don't think there's a lot of political will in Washington right now to revise the law or request an amended report be put out by Treasury. So I think the latter and smarter strategy is actually to divest. And I would also suggest that these parties who have been identified get in front of the Treasury Department and provide evidence to them as to why they are not, they should not be considered as potential sanctions designations.
Now, it's interesting you say that, because regardless of how tense the relationship between our two countries has been, I think up until recently, there was a strong belief, at least here in Russia, that in the United States, businessmen, regardless of their country of origin, are protected by the rule of law from this kind of political arbitrariness. And I wonder if you can still confidently say that that is the case, that the American justice can protect companies that are connected to Russia, Russia as a country rather than the Kremlin, can still be protected from politically driven, whether it is prosecution or even discrimination.
Yeah, so there's an old saying here that in America that justice is blind, and I think that's true, and it cuts both ways, though. It can both be a good thing, and in certain circumstances, it could be counterproductive. And this idea that America will turn a blind eye and protect business interests in the face of the rule of law is inaccurate. And if you need to ask anybody about that, you can ask the number of Iranian and Iranian Americans that have been prosecuted under various sanctions statutes for the last 10 to 15 years about protecting business interests. So, again, I go back to this point, justice is blind and it cuts both ways. And we're seeing it play out here.
Well, it's an interesting turnaround, especially, again, when the United States is concerned, because I think it is perceived internationally as a politically low-risk country. It's clearly no longer the case, as you point out, for the Russians. But I wonder if that arbitrariness at this point is contained only to Russia. What about the other wealthy individuals from other countries? Do you think they should take notice of that?
Yeah, I think they should. And I mean, there was a report just yesterday from Reuters about France now turning to the euro to do trade with Iran. And I think we're going to see that more and more often as people will turn away from the U.S. financial system and the dollar because sanctions at this point are being overused. And this is something that many sanctions experts, including former Treasury officials, have stated. So I think the message is worldwide to wealthy businessmen that if you are engaged in conduct or the U.S. believes you're engaged in conduct, you could potentially become subject to some sort of sanctions restriction or U.S. sanctions law in the future.
But the question is, can you fully divest from the American economy in a way that, you know, you would be still conducting business in countries and will not get into the crosshairs with the American regulators? Is it still possible in this day and age to do business around the world and not be subjected to the American oversight?
Possibly, yes. Very difficult. Also, yes. You know, the fact is that most trade is done in U.S. dollars. There's U.S. persons involved in senior and managerial positions at many multinational corporations. And thus, to your point, yes, it's very difficult to completely avoid the U.S. If you're doing international business on a global scale. But it is possible. And I think there have been examples out there. You know, I've seen my own clients who were unable to use the U.S. system, engage in activity outside of the jurisdiction of the United States successfully. But to your point, it's very difficult.
Now, Mr. Ferrari, the United States is believed to have pretty strong anti-discrimination and libel laws. Do you think that is a promising recourse for companies or individuals who have been denied service because of their national origin?
No, I don't think so. Not in this context. And this is something that we've researched often. We've represented many people on the list. And once we've been able to take them off the sanctions list, they've always wanted to bring suits against the United States for the damage that was caused as a result of the designation. But you have the U.S. government acting pursuant to legislation. And if they're not doing anything outside of their authority and outside the color of law, then no court is going to find the U.S. government to be liable for that activity. I think the smarter route here, particularly for these people on the report, is to seek a determination from U.S. courts that their placement on the report, and in fact, the report itself, may have violated the due process mandates of the Administrative Procedure Act, which is a law that governs federal agency actions.
But Mr. Ferrari, as you pointed out, putting any individual or a company on that list does not necessarily compel anyone to take actions against them. If, let's say, a financial institution denies a service to some Russian individual, can he pursue a discrimination case simply because he, as a Russian, was discriminated for no reason rather than being a Russian?
Right. So, well, there's what you said at the end is the material term. If that's the cause, is because he was Russian, the action was taken, then certainly you may have a case for discrimination. But the bank's response in that case would be, we're not doing this because he's Russian. We're doing this because he was identified on a report of people that have close ties to the Russian government, and also is a potential future sanctions designee So I think a discrimination case in this regard would fail.
Well, Mr. Ferrari, we have to take a short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Eric Ferrari, a Washington-based defense attorney specializing in sanctions. Mr. Ferrari, at the heart of this list, as well as the CATSA law, lie the allegations of Russia's meddling into the American elections. And these allegations may have become accepted as a fact in the broader American political and media discourse, but at this point, at least, they haven't been proven in the court of law, and they haven't been substantiated by any findings of, for example, the Mueller investigation. And I wonder whether within the American legal framework, it is even necessary to prove that charge before meting out punishment to selected individuals.
Right. Well, you have the court of law and then you have the court of public opinion. And to your point, I do think that the court of public opinion has made up its mind. I'm a lawyer and I respect the court of law and what the opinion is of the courts of law and the juries that are impaneled in this country. So I think there, as far as the public's concerned, there something was afoot and something did occur. But you're right. Nothing has been proven yet. And the point as to whether or not it's unfair to take action in respect of this, I think it's important to keep in mind that sanctions are often viewed as a tool of strategic communication, and that the evidentiary standards are very low for bringing a sanctions designation, and sanctions are often utilized when there is not sufficient evidence to bring a criminal prosecution. So all of that leads to the situation now.
Well, so essentially what you're saying is that no, it does not have to be proven in the court of law before those sanctions are introduced against any particular individual.
That's correct.
Now, we just had a very interesting development in Europe with the Court of Arbitration for Sports overturning the suspension of Russian athletes for doping, essentially saying that the burden of proof has not been met and triggering an avalanche of allegations against the court. And I think this is another interesting case when you have a big gap between the court of public opinion and the actual court and the the difference between evidentiary standards for one and another. How big is a challenge, do you think, for the judges to deal with such politically charged cases?
Oh, it's very difficult for judges to deal with this. Particularly, I myself have brought numerous lawsuits against Treasury for sanctions designations. And when you're in this area of law and you're dealing with federal agency action, the courts give what they've referred to themselves as extreme deference to the decisions of the federal agencies involved in the designation process. So it's very much an uphill battle, and most of these cases are resolved through dialogue and communication with the federal agencies themselves rather than through a litigation type process.
I think it also raises a very interesting question that goes to the very fundamentals of the rule of law, whether the adversary or the party that you are absolutely sure is guilty deserves the same legal procedure, the same burden of proof, the same legal standards as others. You're a practicing lawyer. As you said, you often bring cases or argue cases contrary to the American government position. Do you encounter that kind of argument, that kind of attitude in among your opponents, that a certain party, the party that we do not like, doesn't deserve the same legal standard that is suggested by the law?
Well, absolutely. So 2 points on that. The first point is that the U.S. Constitution doesn't protect foreign nationals abroad who are targeted by certain U.S. actions. And then the second point there is that the U.S. doesn't view sanctions as an action against the targeted party, but rather as a placement of restrictions on U.S. persons who may transact with that party. So they don't view it as we've determined this person to be guilty or innocent of a crime. They view it as we believe or we have a reason to believe this person is engaged in certain activity, and therefore we are going to prevent our citizens and our businesses and our permanent legal residents from engaging in transactions with them.
Now, there is one interesting pattern that I think emerged in this court of arbitration for sports ruling and may manifest itself in the American courts as well, that both the doping allegations and the electoral interference allegations are made against the country, but the courts have to deal with individual cases. As far as you know, does the American law allow any possibility of punishing an individual as a proxy for his or her country of origin?
No, not for their country of origin. Stated that way, I don't think that's right. They're certainly built within the various sanctions regimes, subsections of certain authorities which state that if the party material assists a designated party, then they themselves can be subject to those particular sanctions prohibitions. But it's never defined simply by the fact that someone is Russian. The only parallel you may be able to draw is with the North Korea and the Cuban sanctions program, where the authority itself blocks anyone who is a person of those countries, and they're automatically blocked because of the nature of the authorities deployed.
Now, Mr. Ferrari, going back to the ramifications of the Kremlin list, I know that you believe that those named in the list may face delays in financial transactions as international banks subject them to more scrutiny. And I think many people in Russia would actually welcome that because the illicit capital outflow from this country is still significant. According to Russia's central bank, it was around $31 billion last year. Could that possibly be a silver lining in this whole controversy that Western financial institutions will no longer turn a blind eye to money being siphoned off from this country?
Right. So that's an interesting point. And many of my clients often say once they've been put on the list that they'd be happy to have everyone look through their books and through their businesses and see that nothing illicit is ongoing. So that's an interesting point that you raise and one that I hear myself quite often.
Now, I know that there are a lot of Russians, both individuals and companies, who are now trying to lobby in Washington and trying to secure their holdings in the United States. But I wonder if there is any lobbying going on the part of Western financial institutions, because, as I said, the amount of money going out of Russia into whether it is London or New York is pretty substantial. So I assume that business would also be damaged if the Russian money are no longer flowing in.
I haven't heard that. I've heard the opposite, which is that they were putting these persons on the politically exposed persons list and enhanced due diligence. I've been in touch with a number of bankers this week on a variety of matters. And of course, this was discussed on all those calls. And I hadn't heard that, but I suppose it would be a possibility given the financial interests that the banks have.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard you say before that you believe that economic sanctions are an indispensable tool in the U.S. foreign policy kit, that they have proven their value time and time again. And I think that would run counter to the conventional or popular opinion here in Russia, because none of the countries that have been subjected to the American sanctions have actually changed their policy. If anything, they grew more defiant. That applies to Cuba, that applies to North Korea, that applies to Iran, and I think that may apply to Russia as well. So can you give an example of sanctions not only causing pain, I'm sure they do that, but actually succeeding in changing the policy of the country that has been subjected to them?
So 2 points on that. I would note that sanctions are a tool. They are not a strategy. Increasingly in the U.S., we've been using sanctions as the strategy, and that's the wrong approach. We need to use it as part of a toolkit in support of diplomacy. The second point I would make on that is I agree with you that sanctions are not that effective against countries. Targeted sanctions against particular organizations, entities, and individuals I have seen to be very effective because it's much harder for the entire world to turn away from a Russia or an Iran than it is for them to turn away from one individual. So I don't agree with the efficacy of countrywide sanctions programs like we've seen in the past, but the targeted sanctions I have seen to be very effective.
Well, I think it's also a philosophical argument whether you influence people more by engagement or by ostracizing them. And I think the American experience historically presents a much stronger case for economic engagement, be it in Japan or, let's say, Germany, than forced non-engagement. But even if you believe that smart sanctions could be effective, do you think the United States at this point of time is capable of smart policy, whether it is under the Trump administration or even more generally?
Well, I don't want to criticize any administration or how they're using sanctions. Well, what I will say is that over the last several years, both through the Obama administration as well as the Trump administration, we've seen a lot of the institutional knowledge and brain power of the agencies involved in sanctions administration leave for the private sector. So there was a period of time where many of the architects, for example, the Iran program, were all there working together, and they had years and years of sanctions experience, and now they've all gone. And so you have new players coming in, new officials that are looking at these issues. So I think if there has been any kind of shift that we've seen in recent years between both administrations, I would say it's probably due more than that to that than any kind of broader policy decision in the way sanctions are implemented.
Well, I also heard you say that in recent years, particularly following the events in Ukraine, American sanctions have become more narrow in scope. They are often referred to as micro-sanctions, but also broader in application. And I wonder, how does it balance itself out? Does it make sense to use narrower sanctions, but on a broader scale?
I think it does. And here's why. The whole idea of sanctions, you have to look at it as you look at a vice. The idea is to pressure the targeted party to change certain behavior that they're engaged in. And so if you start with putting the most severe restriction on them at the beginning, turning the vice as tight as possible, and they can survive that, then they have no incentive to change their behavior. They're already surviving despite the pressure that's been applied. But if you start the pressure off more slowly, it gives you more room to ramp up sanctions and then increase that pressure to see if you can compel a change in the behavior.
Absolutely. But here, Mr. Ferrari, you're making the case for micro-sanctions. But the second part of my question was also about the overusing of sanction mechanism as such, because money is a persuasive argument, but it's not the only one. Do you see any downsides to using trade and monetary restrictions so often? Because I would think that it may also encourage not only illicit trade and illicit money transfers, but it would also be undermining the free trade system that the United States used to care so much about.
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. And I've said that many times, is I do think we're overusing sanctions. I think a lot of sanctions experts would agree that we're overusing sanctions. And this point about pushing people into illicit networks to move money in formal value transfer systems is absolutely correct. There was a statement several years ago that was made by a then senior official of the U.S. government who said, "We've successfully pushed Iran into the backwaters of the international financial system." And the argument I made at the time is, if you believe Iran is engaged in all this illicit conduct, do you want them in the backwaters of the international financial system? Again, sanctions cut both ways. And since I've made it a theme of this talk to bring up sayings, there's an old saying that you don't want to cut off your nose to spite your face. And sometimes sanctions do that. And their use should be more mediated.
Okay, well, Mr. Ferrari, unfortunately, we have to leave it there, but I really appreciate both your perspective and your time. Thank you for being with us today. And to our viewers, please keep the conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.